Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Okay, so today we're diving into Britney Spears' 2023 memoir, The Woman in Me. Mm-hmm. And wow, I mean, for decades, the whole world watched her, right?
Everyone did. We saw the performances, the fame, the intense media glare, often really cruel.
Exactly. But what this book argues pretty powerfully is that we didn't see the cage. Not really. Not until she basically handed us the key with this memoir.
Yeah, it's like this shattering of a long silence. And what's really striking, I think, is that it's so much more than just a celebrity tell-all.
How so?
Well, many are calling it a landmark cultural document. It's this profound personal testimony, yes, but it's also fundamentally about reclaiming your own story, your own narrative, and honestly, about basic human rights.
Narrative reclamation. That's a really potent phrase.
It is. Because for, nearly two decades, the story about her was written by everyone else, the press, her family, the legal system.
Right.
And this book is her saying, no, this is the authoritative version, mine. For 13 years, she was legally silenced while being one of the most famous people on the planet.
It's that whiplash, isn't it? The super famous global star on one hand and this crushing reality of legal bondage on the other. That's what we want to unpack.
Exactly. And the core question isn't just what happened, but you have to ask how. How does a whole system allow a working adult, a capable person, to be stripped of her autonomy like that for so long?
Okay, so let's trace that journey. To understand the control, we have to go back, way back. Kentwood, Louisiana. It sounds worlds away from Hollywood.
Oh, completely. Small town, deeply religious. And the book paints this really vivid picture of her childhood marked by some serious family dysfunction.
Yeah, she talks about her father's alcoholism, her mother's maybe intense ambition focused on her talent.
And that setup, you know, it made performance both her passion, but also a kind of tool.
A tool for survival.
Survival, escapism, yeah. Getting her parents' attention, their approval, it became this currency. So early on, there's this pressure. Success means stability. Success means validation.
Then she just explodes onto the scene. From the Mickey Mouse Club, which was already super competitive, to global megastar. It's like her entire coming of age happened under this massive public microscope.
Impossibly fast and intensely public. And she's very clear in the book. Her image was meticulously crafted by others, mostly older men.
Right, for marketability.
Mm-hmm.
And it created this paradox from the start.
Exactly. This weird fusion of like virginal innocence, but also this budding sexuality.
She had to be both things at once.
Yeah. Engineered to appeal to everyone, kids, parents. But you can see how that's just inherently unsustainable, right? And kind of toxic.
Totally unsustainable.
Mm.
And it just set her up for the scrutiny that followed, which was relentless and, let's be honest, deeply misogynistic.
Oh, absolutely.
She details the questions she constantly faced about her body, her virginity. Things male stars just didn't get asked.
Yeah.
But she points to one moment as the real turning point where she truly lost control of her own story. The breakup with Justin Timberlake in 2002.
That was huge. The media narrative was instant. She was the villain, the cheater. He was, you know, the wronged party.
And what nobody knew then, the hidden part she reveals in the book, was the abortion she'd had during that relationship.
Devastating. She says he felt they were too young and she went through with it. Carrying that grief, that secret, while being publicly vilified, it's hard to imagine.
She sums up that impossible position so perfectly in the book. That quote where she says, "My image was created by a bunch of men. A girl, but not yet a woman. A virgin, but also a whore."
That says it all, doesn't it? Being forced into that contradictory box, it almost guarantees some kind of crisis down the line.
Which brings us to that period, 2007, 2008, the time that became the justification for everything that followed.
Yes. And the memoir is crucial here because it forces us to recontextualize what we saw.
The head shaving, the paparazzi photos, the public struggles, framed at the time as insanity.
Right. But she reframes them. Not as mental collapse in a vacuum, but as these desperate acts, expressions of grief, of rage, a cry for help.
Fueled by
right.
Postpartum depression, she mentions. Losing custody battles. And just the sheer suffocating media harassment.
She wasn't just struggling. She argues she was breaking down because she was trapped. The behavior was a symptom, not the root cause.
But those very public struggles were then used, very efficiently it seems, as the legal basis for the conservatorship in 2008.
Exactly. And this is where we need to understand the mechanism. Because how do you legally turn a high-functioning, multi-million-dollar earning adult into someone with the legal status of a minor?
That's the crux of it.
Well, a conservatorship, or guardianship in some places, is supposed to be for people genuinely unable to care for themselves. You know, the elderly with severe dementia, people with profound disabilities, people in comas.
Not someone performing complex shows night after night.
Precisely. The court granted two types of control. Conservatorship of the estate, that's the money, the business deals, and conservatorship of the person, that's her actual life.
And that conservatorship of the person sounds almost medieval. They controlled everything.
Everything. Who she saw, where she went, her career moves, and critically, her own body. She writes about being forced onto birth control, the IUD, against her will. She wanted more children.
How is that legally possible? The contradiction is just glaring.
It's stunning. Deemed incompetent to choose her own coffee or friends, or crucially, decide about her own reproductive health.
Yet totally competent enough to perform, tour, run a massive Vegas residency that made millions for the very people controlling her.
That's the core legal absurdity. She uses the phrase child robot to describe her existence.
The examples she gives are chilling in their, like, mundanity sometimes. Performing these huge shows but having zero access to her own credit card.
Having her dad, the conservator, dictate the color of her kitchen cabinets, being told she couldn't have a second cup of coffee, just complete infantilization.
And she says she complied for so long, 13 years, not out of acceptance, but out of fear.
Intense fear, driven by, as she puts it, a fierce protective love for her sons. The constant threat, spoken or unspoken, was that if she stepped out of line, they'd use their legal power to stop her from seeing her kids.
That fear, that maternal protectiveness, became the ultimate lever of control.
Absolutely. It kept her in that situation far longer than anyone could argue was legally justifiable, which leads to that really powerful quote.
The one where she looks back?
Yes. 13 years went by with me feeling like a shadow of myself. How did they get away with it? How did a whole family, a whole team of people, a whole city of lawyers, and a whole system of government get away with treating me, a human being, that way?
It leaves you speechless, really.
Yeah.
So given that level of absolute control, how did she ever find a path out? It wasn't just one legal filing, was it?
No, not at all. It was slow, agonizing. It was about rediscovering her voice, finding the power and saying no.
Let's circle back to the head shaving incident in 2007. You said she reframes it. In the book, she owns it as an act of resistance, right?
A raw, primal act. She was rejecting the image they demanded. She literally says, shaving my head was a way of saying to the world, fuck you all. Taking back control of the one thing she still could, her physical appearance.
That's powerful. A visceral rejection.
And then years later, during the conservatorship, there were these smaller, quieter acts of trying to reclaim some agency. They seem tiny, but they show how deep the captivity was.
Like the story about the fast food?
Yeah, the forbidding French fries during the Vegas residency. A friend sneaks them in. And for her, eating greasy fast food felt like this thrilling, illicit moment of freedom.
When eating fries feels like a revolution.
It tells you everything about the suffocating, infantilizing control she was under.
So these small acts. But what was the real turning point, the shift from just surviving it to actively fighting back?
The book suggests it wasn't one dramatic moment, but a gradual finding of strength. And it seemed to crystallize around the simple act of refusing work.
Just saying no.
Apparently, yeah. She was being pushed into another big commitment, another show, and she just refused, said no.
And that caused chaos.
It sent shockwaves through her team, she writes. Because their entire system relied on her compliance. That no was the crack in the foundation. The child robot was starting to remember she had agency.
And that quiet refusal eventually built towards the huge public moment, the June 2021 court testimony.
Absolutely. That was the culmination. After years of silence imposed by the system and her own fear, she spoke directly to the judge, to the world.
Detailing the abuse, demanding an end to it, specifically mentioning the forced IUD.
It was utterly explosive. She reclaimed her voice, her narrative, in the most public and legally undeniable way possible.
And it worked. It led directly to the conservatorship finally being terminated in November 2021. She went from being the system's victim to the agent of its potential reform.
An incredible turnaround. So thinking about this whole journey, what are the big takeaways? What's the core philosophy here, the legacy?
For me, the core philosophy that shines through is this deep, almost sacred belief in personal freedom, but defined in really basic, tangible ways.
Not fame or fortune?
No. She writes about freedom being able to drive my car, to buy my own candles.
Mm.
It's a stark reminder that it's the small autonomies, the basic choices we take for granted, that are actually the most precious.
That really lands. And intellectually, the takeaway is quite stark, too. The book stands as this damning indictment of a legal system.
How it allowed this.
Yeah.
This civil death, as some are calling it.
Exactly. You're alive, you're working, but you have no rights over your own life. The very legal tool meant to protect vulnerable people was, in her case, seemingly weaponized to exploit a capable adult. It's a systemic failure.
Which brings us to the emotional heart of it, I think. For you, the listener, the deepest tragedy maybe isn't the lost money or fame, it's the lost time.
13 years.
13 years. The book just feels haunted by all the stolen quiet moments, driving her car, being a mom on her own terms, just being an adult. You can't get that time back.
And that's why her story has forced this huge cultural reckoning. We're re-examining the misogyny of the 2000s media, definitely. But crucially, it's sparked real debate and potential action on conservatorship reform.
The system failed her, and now that failure is under a spotlight.
Mm-hmm. Which leads to maybe the most universal insight, the lesson for all of us.
I think it's about resilience, but not resilience as silent endurance. Resilience as the will to fight back. Her story shows that liberation often starts with something quiet, but incredibly powerful. Refusal.
The power of no.
The power of no. She was conditioned her whole life to say yes, to please, to succeed, to survive. Her freedom began when she finally found the strength to refuse.
So we've traced this incredible arc today from that gilded cage of early fame through the literal legal cage of the conservatorship to finally this hard-won freedom and reclaiming her voice.
A really powerful journey laid bare in The Woman in Me.
And maybe a final thought for you to carry forward, building on that theme of refusal and autonomy. Take a moment to think about the systems or expectations or even just narratives in your own life, the things you might automatically say yes to, perhaps out of habit or fear or just compliance.
What's one thing, maybe even a small thing, that you might be ready to say no to right now to reclaim just a little piece of your own life, your own voice, something to consider?
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.